Welcome to the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Produced at the Recording Library of West Texas.
Hello, this is Michael, reading from True West Magazine. November-December 1963 edition. There was no Christmas. If you've had to be steel all your life, it's hard to turn soft, even when the pressure's off. True West salutes a great Montanan who, at age 87, won't trade her horse for a rocking chair. By T.J. Kurtula. The first time I remember seeing Mrs. Mannix, she was in trouble. She was trying to quiet her stage team in Avon, Montana, while the local freight switched cattle cars hardly 100 yards away. The lady was paying particular attention to a half-broke bronc, which, every time the engine chugged by, showed a definite inclination to be long gone. Preparing to depart, the engineer gave several long, loud blasts of the whistle. Those mournful wails and the hissing blast of steam were too much for the hammerhead. With a wild snort, he reared. Mrs. Mannix hung on to the bridle with both hands and went up with him, all the way until her feet left the ground. Again and again he reared, jerking her repeatedly into the air. Finally, as the sound of the train died in the distance, the lady driver got him calmed down and matter-of-factly resumed her loading. This was my introduction to the only woman in Montana, still living, who has handled the reins of a stage team as a regular job. Her record is impressive. For 15 years, she drove the twice-weekly stage from Finn, now a ghost town several miles from her ranch, to the railroad at Avon. It was a round trip of 30 miles, and she made at least 1,560 consecutive trips without a miss. There was only one run she didn't complete. On that morning, as she was preparing to leave, word came from Avon that a severe blizzard was expected momentarily. In fact, it had already reached Helena, 30 miles away, and was roaring westward. She was told she couldn't possibly make the run before the storm struck, so Jim Moore was starting out with the mail and express to meet her. The two met halfway, transferred the loads, and Mrs. Mannix started back just as the leading fog banks of the cold front were beginning to spill down from the Continental Divide. That is not the only example of why she can be called the indestructible Mrs. Mannix. At the age of 20, seriously ill with typhoid, the doctor said she couldn't live through the night. Yet she did. And today, at age 87, she still rides the range on her Nevada Creek Valley cattle ranch. She is quick to admit, however, that the rides are becoming less frequent and that she appreciates little conveniences more, such as mounting from the uphill side. The ranch, operated jointly with her youngest son, Francis, is located between Helmville and Avon. The well-kept farmstead immediately suggests prosperity, but it was not always thus. There have been some very tough years. Mrs. Mannix was born in Canyon Creek, Montana, January 13, 1876. Back when the Indians still had considerable to say about what went on in the area. In fact, when she was barely 6 months old, when they said it to General Custer on the Little Bighorn. Her memories spanned the entire life of the state and well back into its territorial days. Among her most vivid recollections of childhood days are those of the infrequent trips to town, sometimes only twice a year, when supplies were purchased in large quantities, and what you forgot, you went without. Then the family moved to Helmville, where she met and married William Mannix in 1898. From then on, until they purchased the ranch in 1916, their lives were typical of young couples starting out in a frontier cattle country. Their first project upon acquiring the ranch was to build a house and the Big Barn, which is still a landmark in the valley. As the years went by, the White Barn served many purposes other than the one for which it was intended. Among them were benefit dances in the loft for the Red Cross during World War I, and later for their little country school. Almost simultaneously began the heartbreaking years. A husband crippled by polio and the responsibility of 10 children forced her to take on a larger share of the ranch's management. Neighbors remember seeing her in the meadow in a one-horse cart with a baby in the basket beside her. She would tie the horse to a fence, settle the baby in the shade, and go to work. Then she got a chance to drive the twice-weekly stage from Finn to the railroad at Avon. It was the oldest line of its type in the state and carried mail, express, and passengers. The government contract, which was the lifeblood of the line, covered only the mail. The rest of their business they got themselves, and they furnished all their own equipment. One-way fare for a passenger was $1, and rates for cream cans was 50 cents for the outgoing full ones and 25 cents for the return of the empties. The homestead boom was in full swing, and cream shipments were heavy. Mail and express got priority, and passengers hung on where and how they could. A seat might mean the comparative comfort of a pile of mail sacks as compared to the top of a cream can. Sometimes, when the going got really rough, passengers might even have to help out the teams a bit by getting off and walking a while. Wagons in the summer and sleighs in the winter, pulled by four-horse teams, were the regular equipment. During the spring breakup, both were used. Starting out with the sleigh, Mrs. Mannix would transfer to a wagon at some halfway point, usually a ranch. From there on, the road would be all mud. The outgoing trips were always worse, for on them she carried full cream cans, which had to be lifted from the sleigh up into the wagon. Those full 10-gallon cans weighed almost as much as she did. The road followed a low divide between Nevada Creek and the little Blackfoot drainages, which were all prairie, open to the full sweep of the incessant west winds. During the winter, they piled up huge, hard-packed drifts through which the teams bucked and wallowed. On the return trip, all signs of her passing had already been obliterated. During the summer, gumbo, the stickiest stuff known to man, would build up in thin layers on the wagon wheels until they finally reached the point of sliding instead of turning. It was a case of stopping repeatedly to knock it off with a shovel. Then came 1918, the flu year, and the hush, wild rumors of its devastating toll. Early on, a brisk November morning, Mrs. Mannix and her husband started for Deer Lodge, 35 miles away, over a badly rutted and icy road. As they approached Avon, she suddenly suggested, "I think we ought to put on the chains," but he quickly vetoed the idea and they kept on. Attempting to dodge a large rock which had rolled into the road, the rancher lost control and the Model T plunged over the bank down a steep hill to lodge precariously against an arm-sized tree. Neither was hurt, but even with the cane, Mr. Mannix could not make the climb to the road. Fortunately, there was a long rope in the car. Tying it to a bush and placing her feet behind his, Mrs. Mannix helped her husband work his way slowly up the embankment where she left him and struck a beeline for the nearest farm. Crossing the little river by crawling along a fallen cottonwood, still slippery with the night's frost, she reached the homestead only to be told that the horses were all at the far end of the place and on top of a high, steep hill. The owner showed little enthusiasm for climbing up there for them. "Well, I'll go get them," she said, and picking up a rope, started off without a backward glance. Reluctantly, The man followed her. It was evening before the couple got back to Avon, and neither one had had anything to eat since an early breakfast. In the 12 hours that Mannix had waited in the cold on the road, not a single person had passed. The approaching holiday season found the courageous woman with 13 in bed with the flu, stock cattle to feed, 27 cows to milk by hand, and only a peg-legged sailor to help her. Hands, as desperately as they might be needed, weren't easy to get, for many men were reluctant to take jobs on ranches known to have the sickness. Neighbors, no matter how willing, could not always be counted on, for they too were in the same boat. Many already were burying their dead. On his second trip out, the doctor said, "There's good nursing in this house. I didn't expect to see Walter or Ben alive this morning." Years later, her son remarked, "That year, too, there was no Christmas." But Mrs. Mannix remembered that on Christmas Day, for the first time, three of the boys went out to feed the cattle, although all were still so weak that they could hardly stand alone. That crisis was over. Hard on its heels came another one, a brutal nightmare in the memories of all who lived through it. It just forgot to rain, and hot, dry winds seared the ranges until what little grass there was cracked and shattered underfoot. At night, the horizons glowed with the reflections of distant fires. Creeks and springs, never known to do so before, went dry. The hay crop was a complete failure, forcing the ranchers to decide between selling their herds or buying feed. Fortunately, the cattle market held up exceptionally well, and when a buyer offered $90 a pair for cows and calves, the Mannixes were tempted to sell. They consulted their banker. "Are you crazy?" he shouted. "That is the worst thing you could possibly do. The cow alone will be worth $150 apiece next spring." For probably the last time in her life, Mrs. Mannix took the advice of a banker. They fed $40 hay to those potential $150 cows, only to see the market break and cows go begging at $20. The banker had no new advice to cover that situation. He had troubles enough of his own. That 10 years before the rest of the country was to feel it, was the beginning of the depression for the cattleman. After the death of her husband in 1927, Mrs. Mannix reluctantly let the home ranch go and moved to a leased place. At the age of 51, she was left with only one goal, regaining the home place where so many of her happiest years of her life had been spent. Doggedly, she set to work. 20 years later, the ranch was bought back at a figure far greater than what would have been needed to save it in the first place. The day Mrs. Mannix signed the papers was probably one of the high points of her life. Building the rundown ranch back to what it should and could be became her new goal. How well she has succeeded, although she doesn't consider the job finished, is evident by the appearance of the place and the fact that Midwestern feeders scramble for its cattle. Her usual costume of slacks, skirt, and a man's hat has given the lady a fund of stories of being mistaken for a man. One winter, she and her son, Ralph, went to assist a couple whose burning car was stuck in a snowdrift. While the men fought the fire, she chatted with the wife. The husband kept watching and finally interposed himself between them. "Dear," his wife said belatedly, "this is Mrs. Mannix." "'Tis not," the husband retorted, "and I've been watching you flirt with this little man." After she had reached 70, her sons decided that she was too old for her usual hayfield job of driving the dump rake. They broke the news to her as gently as possible, suggesting that she could be just as useful doing other things. Somebody had to cook for the crew, for instance. Their mother quickly caught the point and neither argued nor went near the hayfield. But by evening, she had a cook on the job. The next morning, the boys found that she had taken her horse and had ridden off without even a note to tell where she was going. Mrs. Mannix didn't return until very late that night, late enough to cause them considerable uneasiness, without offering a word of explanation. Day after day, she did the same, until her sons finally hoisted the white flag. Whatever the risks of the haying job, they reasoned, at least they knew where she was and what she was doing. The next day, she was back on her rake, where she has been every summer morning since. Three times, major accidents have resulted in broken bones. The first involved a runaway with the rake team. Fighting flies, one of the team slipped its bridle, and that started a wild, fear-crazed run across the meadow. When the rake hit the first ditch, Mrs. Mannix was thrown off backward, out of the way of the teeth. She came out of it better than the rake, which wound up in 100 pieces, scattered along the route of the run. The next misadventure happened a few years later, when a log she was skidding rolled and pinned her down with a broken ankle. That happened in November. By March, still limping, she was back in the meadow helping feed cattle. At age 75, while bringing in the milk cows early one spring morning, she fractured several ribs when the saddle rolled as her pony made a quick turn. Again, she was thrown clear, but landed on a rock. After the initial shock of the spill, she resaddled and brought in the cows. Mrs. Mannix went through the day doing her usual work without saying anything, but by evening the pain had become unbearable, and she reluctantly told of the mishap. When he heard of it, the hired man looked at her mischievously and drawled, "I thought you was kind of slow bringing in those cows this morning." Among the highlights of recent years was a party given by her family to celebrate her 85th birthday. It was held in the Helmville Community Building a few months early because January weather can be unpredictable. The attendance far exceeded that of the dances given in her barn half a century earlier. Arriving under the impression that the party was being given in honor of an old friend, she thoroughly enjoyed the surprise, especially the unusual birthday cake, which, in keeping with her interests, was decorated with a ranch scene, a miniature rider chasing cattle and horses into a corral. Like all who have spent long days riding, Mrs. Mannix has the ability to sleep in the saddle. Recently, a neighbor met her jogging down the road, obviously dozing. "Hey, Nettie," he shouted, "where are you going?" "I'm taking these cows home." "What cows?" By then, she was awake again. There were no cows. Backtracking, she found them grazing placidly by the roadside. When she fell asleep, her pony sensed it and cut right through the bunch and headed for home, leaving the cattle standing in the road. On the whole, the years of no Christmas have been surprisingly few. In fact, preparing for Christmas now is considerably more of a chore than it was in the early days. Almost 2 dozen grandchildren and more than 3 dozen great-grandchildren tend to keep it that way. True West Magazine, December 2021 edition. The Town of Christmas, Arizona, by Marshall Trimble. In southwestern Gila County, nestled in the remote canyons of the Dripping Springs Mountains, just west of Jerusalem Peak, lies what remains of the old mining town Christmas. In the early 1880s, prospectors Dennis O'Brien and Bill Tweed staked out copper claims. They then sold the claims to Dr. James Douglas, president of Phelps Dodge, but he was unable to file them after it was learned they were located in the San Carlos Apache Reservation. Federal law forbade them from working the area, So Douglas hired O'Brien to squat on the property, and for 20 years, he did. In 1900, George Chittenden, another prospector, also had his eye on the claims. He used his influence to have a bill introduced in Congress to gerrymander the boundary lines to place the claims outside of the reservation. 2 years later, it was about to happen. So Chittenden posted relay riders across the desert and pitched a tent for himself just outside the boundary. The bill passed, and word reached the telegraph station at Casa Grande the day before Christmas, 1902. A relay rider jumped on his horse, and word was passed from rider to rider for 75 miles. The last rider arrived on Christmas Eve to message Chittenden and his partner, N.H. Miller, at their camp. Meanwhile, O'Brien had gone into Globe for some holiday cheer. The next morning, Chittenden and Miller rode into the canyon and staked their claims. Chittenden said later, "I guess we jumped the claims all right, but it was Christmas Day, so we filled our stockings and named the place Christmas." During World War I, Christmas was a boom town. It continued to thrive as a copper ore town, boasting a population of 1,000 at its peak in the 1920s and 30s. During those years, people from all across the nation sent thousands of Christmas cards to the town so they could carry the postmark. That ended when the post office closed on March 30th, 1935. And now, here's an article from a website called Legends of America, exploring history, destinations, people, and legends of this great country since 2003. This article is titled, A Pioneer Christmas. By the mid-1800s, the American Christmas tradition included much of the same customs and festivities as it does today, including tree decorating, gift giving, Santa Claus, greeting cards, stockings by the fire, church activities, and family-oriented days of feasting and fun. But for those in the Old West, far away from the more civilized life of the East, pioneers, cowboys, explorers, and mountain men usually celebrated Christmas with homemade gifts and humble fare. Christmas for many in the Old West was a difficult time. For those on the prairies, they were often barraged with terrible blizzards and savage December winds. For mountain men, forced away from their mining activities long before Christmas, in fear of the blinding winter storms and freezing cold, the holidays were often meager. But to these strong pioneers, Christmas would not be forgotten, be it ever so humble. Determined to bring the spirit of Christmas alive on the American frontier, soldiers could be heard caroling at their remote outposts. The smell of venison roasting over an open hearth wafted upon the winds of the open prairie, and these hardy pioneers looked forward to the chance to forget their hard everyday lives to focus on the holiday. Laura Ingalls Wilder wrote of the preparations for Christmas on the Kansas prairie. "Ma was busy all day long, cooking good things for Christmas. She baked salt rising bread and Reinjen bread and Swedish crackers and a huge pan of baked beans with salt pork and molasses. She baked vinegar pies and dried apple pies and filled a big jar with cookies, and she let Laura and Mary lick the cake spoon." That very Christmas, Laura Ingalls was delighted to find a shiny new tin cup, a peppermint candy, a heart-shaped cake, and a brand new penny in her stocking. For in those days, these four small gifts in her stocking were a wealth of gifts to the young girl. Though perhaps modest, these hardy pioneers made every attempt to decorate their homes for the holidays with whatever natural materials looked attractive at the bleakest time of year, such as evergreens, pine cones, holly, nuts, and berries. For some, there might even be a Christmas tree, gaily decorated with bits of ribbon, yarn, berries, popcorn, or paper strings, and homemade decorations. Some of these homemade decorations were often figures or dolls made of straw or yarn. Cookie dough ornaments and gingerbread men were also popular. In other places, wood was simply too scarce to waste on a tree, if one could be found at all. Other pioneer homes were simply too small to make room for a tree. At the very least, almost every home would make the holiday a time of feasting, bringing out preserved fruits and vegetables, fresh game if possible, and for those that could afford it, maybe even beef or ham. Many women began to bake for the holiday weeks ahead of time, leaving the plum pudding to age in the pot until Christmas dinner. Many of the homemade gifts, including corn husk dolls, sachets, carved wooden toys, pillows, footstools, and embroidered hankies, might have had the family members working on for months ahead of Christmas. Others knitted scarves, hats, mittens, and socks. If the family had a good year, the children might find candies, small gifts, cookies, and fruit in their stockings. Christmas Eve would generally find most families singing carols around the Christmas tree or fireplace. On Christmas Day, most would attend church, return home for the traditional Christmas meal, and spend the day visiting with friends and neighbors. Then, as it is today, Christmas would also find many a mountain man, explorer, or lone cowboy spending a solitary evening without the benefit of festivities. The more things change, some things inevitably remain the same. Article by Kathy Weiser, Legends of America, updated April 2017. Here's an article from True West Magazine's November-December 1956 edition. One Man's Blizzard. Things got sort of rocky around this cow camp before that cold spell blew itself out. By Bill Miller. Everything rugged happened to me in the Nevada blizzard, which marked the year of Operation Haylift out of Elko. I was feeding 300 mothering cows in sage and short grass when the sky blacked out. Starting easy-like, the wind blew to a gale in an hour. The straight-falling snow suddenly rose a quarter circle and blew horizontal, and even with the feed wagon downwind from stack, it got impossible to load. I finally turned the stock through the barbed wire corral fence and let them feed in the stack. This gave them a break against the driving wind. My face began to freeze, and I knew the mercury was low. I pulled the down flaps about my ears, but my protruding nose felt like an icicle. I thought of my wood supply, down to the last couple of juniper chunks. Beans and coffee were at low ebb, with barely enough pancake flour for a couple of breakfasts. The supply jeep was overdue. Chances of it arriving now were zero. Supposing it couldn't make it for a month? What if I couldn't negotiate the 4 miles to our woodlot for fuel? The cow camp was old and leaky as a sieve. I had intended making some repairs, but had never gotten around to it. In a pinch, I could sleep in the barn and get warmth from Mike and Jerry. They were young and fought a tight rein, but were docile enough out of the harness. Back at camp, I took stock of grub. Enough for a week at most. I found a reserve bottle of brandy and swigged a good one. The shot stirred my blood and brought vigor. I built a fire in the kitchen and pulled in my bed to conserve wood. Outside, I split my last two chunks and loaded them in the wood box. Might last 2 days, I figured. As I brought in the last armful of wood, I glanced at the weather glass. The mercury read 20 below. Holy mackerel, I thought. By tomorrow morning, it will drop to 40. I made a supper of pancakes and bacon. The kitchen was warm with cook stove heat. I piled into bed, snug and comfortable, shutting my mind against tomorrow. Next morning, I rolled out before daylight. My lamp oil was out, but I had a can of gasoline. Dangerous, but effective. The wood took hold, and I soon had coffee and a smidgen of bacon. From now on, I was on a food budget. Out in the hay corral, the cows were undercutting the stack and getting some cover on the lee side. Already a dozen calves lay dead from cold and scours. I dragged them out and let the snow cover again. One old cow was stiff, but I let her lay until I brought the team and chain. When I left the house, the glass read 38 below zero, cold enough to freeze anything alive. I ran back to the shack before it caught up with me. I could almost feel the blood congeal in my arteries. The fire was still glowing in the stove, and I stoked it again. In a pinch, I could drag in some sage butts. I looked at the clock on the stove. It said 9:30. There would be daylight time to make the juniper lot. I made a break for the barn, and the trouble started. Jerry, the off horse, always fought the head stall. I usually gave him time to think it over. Then, when he dropped his head, I'd slip it on. Today I was in a rush to get going. I snubbed his head tight to the manger and tried force. No go with Jerry. One jerk, the rope broke, and I slammed against the rail, bang, across the kidneys. Wood had got to be got, so I managed to hook the team to the old work wagon, one of those ancients with a high diamond spring seat. Halfway to Juniper's, we jolted over a snow-covered log, and wham went the spring seat, rusted through age and exposure. I managed to swing to the wagon bed and curb the team, though the pain in my back nearly killed me. Finally, Mike and Jerry smoothed out, and we were making good time when all hell broke loose. Here came 1,000 antelope tearing through the rimrock fence. God, I thought, with everything else, I would have had to oust the antelope and make the fence tight. At the junipers, I couldn't find any ready-cut wood, so I felled a dead tree and dragged the limbs aboard. My lame back made a horror of this, but I took the edge off the pain with the help of a half a fifth of brandy. That night, my dreams were nightmares. I could hear coyotes howling a deadly chorus. Next morning, I knew why. 10 calves were missing on the count, besides 8 more frozen alongside the stack. Driving staples and stretching wire at 40 below ain't fun, but I got the job done by dark. My Savina saddle horse stumbled 100 times on the sub-snow lava rock and finally dumped me heavily when he went to his knees. Now I had a damaged shoulder, which had struck a rock, but the job on the fence was done, and I could fight the pain with heat. Next 2 days were hella plenty. My grub ran out, except for 2 rounds of batter cakes and a taste of sugar to sweeten. From here on in, I was a child of destiny. The stock had hay. All I had was an empty belly. Then I came to life. High time. I grabbed my 30-30 and took off for the corral. With fire, I could have young veal. I'd hardly reached the cows when I heard a roar of a plane. I looked up and saw the pilot dip a howdy. Then I saw sacks dropping toward me. There were beans and canned goods, swathed in sweaters, and 2 bottles of brandy. A note attached to one of the sacks read, "Sorry, Bill, we can't help with the weather. Keep chin up. Good luck. A week later, the wind died, the sun shone, the mercury soared. Life was good again. Here's an article from True West Magazine's November-December 1959 edition. Avalanche. Only gold could make men risk nature's cruelest whim. By Marvin Gregory. In February 1958, the great snow deposits in the High Sierra San Juans of southwestern Colorado began to grumble as warm weather approached. Everyone knew the danger of avalanches letting go any moment and sending millions of tons of snow down the mountainside, sometimes for distances up to 3 miles. On St. Valentine's Day, Ted Mason and Harry Peck, believing they would be needed to clear the road from Camp Bird Mine to Ouray, went by jeep as fast and as far as they could go, and then struck out on foot, climbing over mountains and snow. They safely passed the waterhole slide and were almost in sight of the mine when the grumbling started. They were traveling some distance apart, as they should have been in avalanche country. Mason, who was wearing his parka over his head, apparently did not hear the warning. He put his head down and plowed onward. Peck started back, but the great avalanche of tumbling snow and rocks caught him in its fringe and hurled him 30 feet or more into a snowbank. The great slide filled the air with powdered snow so that for several minutes it was like a heavy, obscuring fog. The mountains echoed with the savage roar. As soon as the air cleared so he could see where he was going, Peck started to Camp Bird for help. A young geologist, Charles Scotty Bruce, and Peter Beaumont, mining engineer, hurriedly plowed through slides and snow to spread the word at Ouray. County Commissioner Oscar Franz quickly organized a rescue squad by ordering the fire siren blown. By mid-afternoon, more than 40 men were on the scene to start rescue work. The danger of further slides made their efforts hazardous. The snowfield was as much as 50 feet deep in places, and digging a man out, dead or alive, was impossible unless one happened to know exactly where the victim was, and no one could be sure about that. The rescuers began probing here and there, little groups starting tunnels into the snowbank, none very hopeful of success. 40 men looked like a cluster of ants on that big slide. We were all standing pretty much in a group, feeling frustrated and hopeless, when Dave Calhoun came running from the direction of the mine. As soon as he was within hailing distance, he signaled and called, "Bring your shovels and come over here. Another one just ran, and it's got 3 men in it." The schoolhouse slide had just run and had caught 3 men who were working with bulldozers in an attempt to open the road down to the slide which contained Mason's body. The 3 were Walter Smith, mine superintendent for Camp Bird Limited, Mike Moransky, a miner, and Danny Jarrell, bulldozer operator for Ouray County. Actually, 4 men were caught. Joe Martinez was there too. He saw the snow break loose, way up at the top of Mount Hayden, shouted a warning to the 3 other men, and ran for it. Joe was caught in the fanning out motion as the slide settled on the road. He was carried along for 100 feet and deposited unhurt in 2 feet of snow at the side of the road. Joe came back to the site to aid in locating the men who were buried. When asked, "Did you see if the other men ran and which way?" he replied, "I don't know. I was too busy running myself." Jarrell's bulldozer and another driven by Walter Smith had been covered. The 2 cats were needed in the rescue operation. Finally, both bulldozers were located, but getting them out of the powdery snow imposed a problem. As fast as the white sugary stuff was shoveled away, it would slide back and settle deeper. Darkness came on swiftly, and by then, everyone was too exhausted to continue. The following day, February 15th, the weather was cloudy, but warm, perfect conditions for the breaking loose of more avalanches. Only cat skinners were permitted to work that day in an attempt to open the road to the top in order to facilitate further search for bodies of the victims. Sunday, February 16th, officials posted the road closed and ordered all persons, except cat skinners, to stay out of the area. The weather had warmed up still more, and the situation was critical. On Monday, a small bulldozer was successfully walked over the remaining slides, and one of the buried cats was extricated. Then the tough job of clearing snow down to the roadbed began. Very slowly and carefully, they plowed, watching for any sign of a body. By Wednesday morning, the three corpses had been found. The big slide in which Ted Mason lay was still to be worked. Locations and positions of the three men caught in the second slide proved that they had indeed attempted to run to safety. They were several feet apart, whereas they had been standing in a group. They were some distance from the dozer, and one body was still upright in a running position. The snow had packed around him so quickly that it caught and held his body in mid-stride. He obviously had suffocated. Ted Mason's body was found and recovered on Thursday. The 1958 disaster was just a new chapter in a long history of snowslides in the San Juans. We can reach back through the years since the white man first occupied this area and recount story after story of the tragedies and destruction wrought by avalanches, some said to have been clocked at speeds exceeding 300 miles per hour. The banner headline in the February 28, 1936 issue of the Ouray Herald proclaimed, "Snowslide kills three. King Lease will rebuild." Subheads on the avalanche story said, "Buildings at Camp Bird mine demolished. Camp E. Woods, Ralph Klinger and Mrs. Rose Israel killed under avalanche when buildings are wrecked or badly damaged. Working of clearing debris started preparatory to rebuilding." That winter, Camp Bird operations were being carried on at the upper camp, 3 miles up the mountains from the big Camp Bird mill. That particular camp is located in what is known as Imogene Basin, at an elevation of more than 11,000 feet. The mountains tower another 2,000 or 3,000 feet above the camp, almost completely encircling the basin. On Monday, February 24th, about 9:45 a.m., the Chicago, the Hidden Treasure, a slide known simply as the Second Level, and numerous other slides and slips all loosed almost simultaneously and thundered down the mountains to converge at the bottom of the basin. The King Lease Mill, the boarding house, bunkhouse, mule barns, and all the buildings required for the operation of the famous mine were enveloped by the avalanche. Telephone lines remained in operation just long enough for an Ouray operator to hear, "For God's sake, send help. All the slides have come." Then the lines went dead. The Ouray Herald later reported, "The news was sent about town immediately, and a volunteer rescue party of about 30 citizens was organized and left Ouray at 11:30 with all available horses, mules, and snowshoes. The road to Camp Bird Limited was blocked with drifts and snowslides. The party had to shovel and force its way through and over the snow. It was late in the afternoon before the party reached the scene of the tragedy at Camp Bird. Workers dug frantically until the last body, that of Chap Wood, was recovered late on Tuesday afternoon. B.F. Winters, a crippled elderly photographer, made the trip with the rescue party. The journey was so difficult for even the ablest of men that many wondered how Winters managed to get there and take photographs. There were at least 10 men who used the miner's phrase, "God sure had his arms round me that time." While Rose Israel, camp cook, Chap Woods, the mill superintendent, and Ralph Klinger, mine blacksmith, were all killed, these 10 men sleeping on the second floor of the bunkhouse were spared. For some inexplicable reason, that particular bunkhouse was not destroyed nor buried, except up to the second floor. Not one of the 10 was even injured. Rescuers found James Ruff Dunn, mine foreman, buried under a great pile of snow and debris. Timbers had somehow crossed and formed a small pocket containing enough air for him to breathe. They also prevented the snow from crushing him. He was rescued, still conscious, but suffering from cold and shock. At the time of the slides, 27 miners were working their shift inside the mine. They knew nothing of the slides until they reached the portal and found it blocked tightly with packed snow. Nobody knew how deep. They made their way back through the mine to an alternate portal higher up the mountain and gophered out and upward through 20 feet of snow. To get out, they had to dig a tunnel big enough for a man to pass through, stowing the loosened snow back inside the mine as they excavated their gopher hole. They were thankful just to have been safe inside the mountain when they learned what had happened during their shift. Just a few hundred feet from the site of the 1958 disaster, the waterhole took the lives of 4 men and 27 horses on February 21, 1909. The February 22, 1909, Ridgeway Sun told it this way. Terrible snowslide near Camp Bird Mill. At 4 o'clock yesterday afternoon, a monster snowslide came down at the waterhole on the Sniffles Road, about 1 mile below Camp Bird Mill. 5 men and 27 horses were carried down in the slide, and the only living creature that escaped was F.M. Austin, familiarly known as Dad. The men known to have perished are Pete Sinott, Dr. S.G. Duguit, George Nurr, and John Mitwer. Dad Austin was dug out of the slide uninjured, save for a few slight bruises. The bodies of Pete Sinott and Dr. Duguit have been recovered, but owing to the severity of the storm, which was still raging up to a late hour last night, all work of rescuing had to be abandoned, as another slide is liable to occur at any time. The storm, which has prevailed in the mountains for the past 3 days, is the most severe ever known, and the slide is of tremendous proportions. It is feared that the bodies of the lost men will lie where they are now until the snow melts in the spring. The Sun's predictions was borne out. The other 2 men were not recovered until much later, one of them in late May. The men and the horses involved in that incident were part of an ore train. In those days, supplies were freighted to the mines high up in the mountains by great wagons drawn by teams of sixes. Usually, there were several wagons in a train, and always the train was accompanied by a wagon boss who rode horseback. On this day, the train had gone up with supplies for both the Camp Bird and Revenue mines. The Revenue mine is located 3 miles farther up, and the road is mostly a shelf built around the base of Mount Potosi. After discharging their loads, all wagons rendezvoused at Camp Bird and took on their loads of ore for the return trip to Ouray. As the train began its return trip, it was joined by the bullion stage, the rig that hauled the pure gold bars from the mill to be shipped by rail from Ouray to the mint in Denver. In spite of the hazardous conditions existing, the train reached the site of the waterhole slide. A small slip had already come down, sufficient to block the road, so that it was impossible for the horses to pull their loads through it. It was also impossible to turn a team of sixes around on that shelf road. All the drivers well knew the grave danger to which they were exposed. It was quickly decided to unhitch all the horses and send them out of the area and to get out themselves as fast as possible. All men fell to unhitching horses and starting them on the run down the hill. Drivers rushed in to help the other men as fast as possible. For some of them, it was already too late. The waterhole swished down its 3-mile course, burying a 4-wagon segment of the train along with the drivers and horses. Dad Austin, the driver of the bullion stage, was one of the men who had attempted to aid some of the wagon drivers. He had left his seat on the stage and ran down towards some of the wagons just as the slide engulfed them. Charles Alderson, the guard on the stage, quickly ran with his shovel to the spot where he had last seen Dad, dug him out, and revived him before he was suffocated. In 1906, a series of slides ran in Imogene Basin, much as they did in 1936. However, that time, they were so big that the basin could not contain them. That big bowl that is Imogene Basin overflowed out its only opening directly over the huge Camp Bird Mill and completely demolished it. A 2-story bunkhouse at the camp was twisted round on its foundation, giving its 50 or so occupants a very unpleasant ride. Following that, a heavy cable was anchored into a nearby boulder, which is as big as a bunkhouse, run through the building and fastened to an anchor plate on the other side to prevent the building being pushed in the creek, should another such slide occur. To this day, the cable may still be seen, still anchored to the rock and running through the bunkhouse. A couple of other stories we happen to have some acquaintance with are too interesting to leave out of this account. One of them is the story of Jack Bell, who was buried in the Riverside slide up along the old toll road, now a modern surfaced highway called the Million Dollar Highway. It was on a day in the winter in 1901. Several men were making their way along the road, traveling apart, as experienced mountain men do when they are traveling in avalanche country. As they passed along under the riverside, it chose just that moment to run. All were safe but Jack Bell. He was caught by the slide. Quickly, an attempt at rescue was made. The men dug and probed, but there, too, the task was a hopeless one. Finally, the search was abandoned. Jack wasn't dead, however. When the slide came, he was just at a point along the road where a small tunnel into the cliff discharges a stream of water. At that time, since only teams and rigs traveled the road, the water was simply trenched across the road and run into the gorge. He was knocked down, face to the ground, and head toward the tunnel into the stream of water. For some reason, his face was not forced into the water so that he had just a little space in which to breathe, and the stream running down to him carried a little air. After a time, water backed up in the ditch sufficiently to cause the snow around Jack to slush. Soon, by wriggling his fingers and flexing his arms, he was able to slowly stretch his arms out beyond his head. He clawed snow into the water, allowing it to melt around him until he was finally able to wriggle his entire body. No grave could be darker than it was where Jack was buried alive. Since he was still conscious, he could tell by the direction of the flow of the water where he was heading, and he remembered the spot where he had than just before the slide came. Inch by inch, he clawed snow. All his fingers were frozen. The clawing broke off portions of them. But he continued, on and on, for several hours. At last, he gained the mouth of the tunnel, which he knew to be the source of the little stream. From there, he gophered out on top and made his way, wet and half-frozen, 2 miles down to the toll house at Bear Creek Falls. He had been buried in the early afternoon. Now it was midnight. The man who occupied the toll house knew, as everyone in Ouray, that Jack Bell had been killed in the Riverside slide. He ran out the back door and all 3 miles into Ouray, screaming that the dead man had just walked in on him. Will Andrews, who still lives here, and to whom I am indebted for this story, was driving a rig for Arps Brothers Hardware. He had just come in from a late trip and had not yet unhitched his team. Mr. Andrews drove the 3 miles to Bear Creek Falls to bring Bell into Ouray, where he received medical care and a warm bed. Another man, not so lucky as Jack Bell, was Swin Nilsson. On December 23, 1883, Swin, the mail carrier, set out on his route from Silverton to Ophir. At that time, the railroads had not yet been built to all camps in the San Juan Mountains, and in many cases, mail was carried in by backpacks by men on snowshoes. Storms had been heavy and were still raging. Friends had tried to dissuade Nilsson from going until conditions were more favorable. This time, though, he had Christmas mail, and he felt it would be a great shame if those people in Ophir didn't get it on time. He was determined to make the attempt, but he never reached Ophir. As soon as it was learned in Ophir that Nilsson had gone out on the trail with their Christmas mail, search parties were organized. No trace could be found of their lost mail carrier. During the spring and summer, the search was continued. Another winter came and went without a clue as to the whereabouts of the lost man. In August 1885, 2 years later, another searching party at last found the body of Nilsson, the mail sack still strapped to his back. It had taken 2 years for the glacier to move down and open up to relinquish the body of the man it had held for so long. All of the stories we have told are true. They are Old West, and they are the present West. As you can see, not all the violence of the West can be seen through blue gun smoke. To describe the violence, the unbelievable force, the terrific speed, the thunderous noise, the blood-chilling terror brought to anyone in close proximity to an avalanche is impossible, with words or even with pictures. Only old-timers who have had experience with those things know what they can be like. All these stories of avalanches centered in a very small part of the Great San Juan Mountains, 6 miles out of Ouray. The most fantastic-seeming part of the stories is that men continue to mine in this area. Yet the lure of gold is so strong in a mining man that not even the threat of death can dissuade him from searching for and digging out the yellow metal.
Thank you for joining us for the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Your narrator has been Jack. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.